Fixing hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an FU commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part two.
I'm Greg Wyshynski of the worldwide leader ESPN, live from Beantown.
Well, I mean, let's not call it that, but I'm Ryan Lambert from Yahoo.
I am Sean McIndoe from my basement in Ottawa.
Oh, like a blogger. And you're in Puck Soup, where we are talking on the morning after the stupendous Game 7 victory by your St. Louis Blues to capture their first Stanley Cup in franchise
history. This was their first one? I hadn't heard that.
they defeated Charlie Coyle, who I believe grew up somewhere in the Boston area. Boy, was it like watching the 95 Devils last night.
It was not a fun game.
It was assassin-like efficiency on the defensive end of the ice. They played a perfect road game. I will be once again correct in my prognostication, not in the number of games. I said Blues in six, but it was Blues in seven. And for the very reason that I said, which is that their acumen for winning on the road, the style with which they played, Jordan Binnington bouncing back after losses. Tuukka Rask's game seven number is not exactly what you'd wanted of a elite goalie, by the way. Not to get all Joe Haggerty on you.
I mean, that's getting extremely Joe Haggerty on us. I mean, was any single one of those goals remotely his fault? I don't feel like it was.
No, I mean, it wasn't, but
it was what did he stop? 16 of 20 or whatever it was? Like, it wasn't good, but...
But, I mean,
That was the team in front of him totally shitting their pants.
But even you... card-carrying, flag-waving member of the anti-Jordan Binnington club have to admit that he outplayed Tuukka Rask in the most important game of the season.
Yeah, he definitely did. He made, I would say, probably three saves that he absolutely needed to make, and the rest of the time, Colton Parayko and Alex Pietrangelo just didn't come off the ice the entire game. They played like 9 minutes without one or two of them on the ice. So, yeah, I mean... They definitely made his job easy, but when he needed to make the saves on like Nordstrom and I think Coyle had a good look and maybe
Johansson had one too.
Johansson, yeah.
Yeah.
He had three really good saves. Tuukka Rask had maybe two good saves, and he definitely outplayed Tuukka Rask. There's no two ways about that.
Sean, before we get to you, I just wanted to mention that I laid my 95 Devils theory on none other than 10-time now Stanley Cup champion Larry Robinson. I said, did you get a little 95 Devils vibe from the game tonight? And his answer was, 95? I can't even remember last week. An actual quote from a Hall of Famer, Larry Robinson.
That is an all-time Sean? Old guy quote. That is fantastic. First, on the goaltending... That Jordan Binnington third period save, where he gets across with the pad,
like that's the Nordstrom one.
We are gonna see that for years to come. Like if there's any justice, that'll be like the defining play, not in the sense that the whole series revolved around Jordan Binnington, but just like that was such a great save, and it was. The rare great save that actually was a great save. Like, so many great saves are just the guy is sprawled out and they shoot the puck into his glove and we all freak out anyways because we're so starved because goaltenders haven't moved since 1997. we miss, guys actually using their limbs and that, this was that was an all-timer save. So that's that was the turning.
To your point, that's, by the way, why Tim Thomas is, like, beloved in Boston is because he was out of position every time he ever faced a shot.
Exactly, yeah. Like, him and like Dominic Hasek were the only two guys that, like, didn't make 98% of their saves by just, like, coming out, cutting down an angle, and getting hit right in the logo. So, that was great. And, you talk about it reminding you of 95. I think maybe even the more obvious comparison is 2011 when Boston went into Vancouver and did pretty much exactly this to the Canucks. Mm. You know, a little bit different circumstances, but that feeling of like, all right, here we go, home ice. And then, you know, they get the first goal and you go, oh, okay, well, they're going to need the second. And then they don't get the second one. And then the game's going on and you're just thinking like, this is happening. Like, we're not even going to get the big push at the end here. This is just one team is shutting the other one down completely.
How dare you, sir? Matt Grizzlick had that one goal when it was like 17 to nothing. And
you know, yeah, so I'm sure
all things seem possible.
I'm sure every Canucks fan is just brokenhearted to see the Bruins have to go through that last night. That was
for sure. And kudos to Boston for not burning down their own city, which I think if you think of all the cities in America where a sports loss might result in such a calamity, Boston probably top three cities. I do want to mention before, Ryan, you're going to chime in about Tim Thomas and about what happened before this game, which is the waving of the Boston fan banner before the game is without question one of my favorite manufactured dramas of the playoffs. It's this constant harangue of rumors within the arena on who it might be. And so let's take us through it. The first name that came to mind and was being bandied about was TB12 himself, Tom Brady. The rumors were always that Brady was going to show up for a Game 7, that he wouldn't show up if it weren't a Game 7. That's
he doesn't get
Brady
out of bed for anything but right. Game 7, yeah.
Right. So the rumor was it was going to be Brady. Apparently, according to someone who works with the Patriots, said this to Emily Kaplan, my colleague at ESPN, he had a scheduling conflict, which I can only assume was his quack trainer injecting stem cells into his brain so he stays young. So TB12 did not make a Game 7. This then led to reference your Tim Thomas thing, the wildest rumor of the playoffs.
Yeah, insane.
Which is that Tim Thomas would emerge from his bunker, tossing aside those cans of soup, laying down his arms, fly across the country, come to Game 7, wave the Bruins fan banner on a night in which a player who really doesn't like Tim Thomas, Tuukka Rask, would be trying to win the Stanley Cup for himself. And that rumor was actually propagated by Darren Millard, of all people in Canada, saying there was a strong possibility of it happening. It did not happen. And again, if it was going to happen, wouldn't it happen when the rest of the 2011 Bruins had a reunion earlier in the series?
Yeah.
Probably, I'm going to guess. And then, of course, the maybe even more crazier than the Tim Thomas rumor was the logical step from the Boston media from, well, you know, if we can't get Timmy Thomas, obviously the next option would be to sneak a banner into David Ortiz's hospital room and have him wave it on the Jumbotron. So that became the new thing, that David Ortiz, a man recovering from a gunshot wound, who moments before Game 7, it was revealed there was a murder conspiracy involving several different individuals in the Dominican Republic, that Jeremy Jacobs was going to be like, all right, my little flying monkeys, fly to David Ortiz's room and give him a fan banner to get him on the Jumbotron. And so that didn't happen, and there was a huge letdown in the arena because I think people actually thought it would happen. And then, of course, it ends up being Liam Fitzgerald, the delightful fist bump kid, a super fan for the Bruins who went viral a few years ago. And then behind him, like two dancers from the David S. Pumpkin sketch, is Julian Edelman and Ali Raisman and David Ortiz jerseys. From that moment on, I knew the Blues were going to win, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was a little more confident when the Bruins were out shooting them like 19-2 that the Bruins might have this one locked down. But yeah, the thing I was going to say earlier is once Petrangelo scored, I was like, well, that's fucking end of that. We're done here.
Oh, all right. That goal, by the way, my God.
What an awful fucking line change by Marchand. Like, yeah. That should haunt him for the rest of his career.
Marchand is floating towards the bench. The puck comes out of the zone. Marchand then decides to try to play defense, not necessarily his forte, and gets smoked. And there, I took a screenshot of it and put it up on Twitter last night. There's a moment in which there are three Bruins all in a row coming off the bench as the Blues get a 3-on-2 down low. And it's like it reminded me of planes waiting to land at an airport. You know, where you look up in the sky and you can see the lights all lined up as they're trying to all land at the same time. Like, that's what it was off the Bruins bench, because it was such an atrocious fucking change.
I think you're being very charitable to say what he tried to do there was play defense. I think he tried to vaguely stand in Petrangelo's way, and when that didn't work, he was like, nah, I got to go sit down anyway, so...
Yeah, and that's the problem with being Brad Marchand these days, is that he's clearly trying to turn over a new leaf. The old Brad would have fucking tilt-a-whirled him or speared him in the balls to prevent him from getting into the zone, but not the new Brad.
Yeah,
I don't know about that.
You hate to see it, but really, in his defense, you have to get fresh guys out there for the last 8 seconds, right? I mean, that's a big shift. Oh, you wouldn't want to be tired for 8 seconds. Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah, that was a disaster.
Can I just point out, sorry guys, just before please. We keep going, just to go back to the banner thing, if people didn't see it, I think the highlight of yesterday was during the day while everyone was speculating about the banner thing, I threw a tweet out there and I said, who would be the worst possible choice to wave the banner? And I put a couple options out there, like Bernard Pollard, Ray Bourque in an Avalanche jersey. And my problem was, I didn't say like I said who would be the worst choice. So you can imagine some of the replies I got. Like it was all tweets are mistakes, but this one particularly was a mistake. Up until Roberto Luongo tweet quoted it and said, "Okay, I'll go do it," which I thought was. And also, honestly, might have been a slightly better choice than Fist Bump Kid was great, but the rest of it was very clear they did not have a plan B after Tom Brady. So, yeah, next time Roberto and Tim Thomas together could have been good on a Unity ticket.
Okay, we're talking.
did Craig Janney get a call to help bridge the Blues Bruins gap? Probably not, I'm going to guess.
How far down the list did they go?
Down the list. Well, Dennis Leary didn't get a call, I don't think. But
he was there, though. They made a point to show him.
Oh, speaking of celebrities,
he was worried he might have to say something, and Bill Hicks never did it before, so he wouldn't have known what to do.
Ah, there it is. John Krasinski was at the Bruins game last night, and I can't even put into words the amount of respect I have for this man now, because he put up a video on Instagram showing that he was at the Bruins game, and as everyone knows, Jenna Fischer, TV's Pam, is a huge Blues fan, brings Pam's television ex-boyfriend, Roy.
They were engaged, Greg.
Okay, fiancé Roy. Who, by the way, Jim broke up their engagement.
Yes.
And crossing enemy lines to troll Pam Beasley. My God, this is the television sitcom equivalent of face licking. That's the level of trolling we're talking here. It was astounding. Fantastic work.
Really good.
So the game played out exactly how it needed to for the Blues, in the sense that, boys, there was one penalty called, and it was a penalty they had to call. Mm-hmm. It was a procedural penalty. Not a single penalty called either on a hook, a hold, a obstruction, which there was plenty of. Your thoughts on the officiating in Game 7? Let them play, boys, as they say.
Yeah, it was a Game 7. What did you think? They were going to give fucking Boston 5 power plays? Come on, dude.
But I didn't really – like, did you get the sense as you were watching it? Because there are games where they are – quote unquote letting him play, where it's just a rodeo and you're sitting there like, come on, like, you've got to start calling them. Like, it didn't seem
there were a couple sequences in the second period where it was like, that's a trip and that's a trip and also that's a trip.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it seemed like one of those things where you would go, okay, we'll give you the first two, but that third one we can't let you get by.
Yeah.
And it never right. happened. So
I thought the officiating last night was fine, which is what the NHL needed. You were like, if you work at the NHL, you were just on your knees praying that you would get through a game seven without some crazy stuff. And yeah. I was surprised. Oh, I thought for sure Boston was going to get like the one courtesy power play in the third period because they were down two mm-hmm. goals, which is usually
the
how it works.
Power
but
play.
Yeah, I mean, it's I still. I still don't know how you would explain to a new hockey fan that, like, well, yeah, I mean, they're playing 60 minutes and they're hitting each other and there's some trips and hooks and holds, but we don't call those because we let them go. And then they're like, well, how come you had to call the time the puck went over the glass? And you're like, yeah, that's the only one that we literally call everything. As long as the puck doesn't go over or somebody's stick doesn't get slashed, everything else is to their discretion. But that one little thing, right, we have to call.
Or too many men. That'd be the other thing too.
Even that one seems optional half the time, but yeah.
Yeah, like on the one Bruins power play, St. Louis had a good 8 seconds of having five guys on the ice. So I didn't even notice it. Like Eddie Olczyk, I think, was the one who said it on the broadcast, was like, there are five guys out there right now.
Eddie Olczyk is good at three things: ignoring whatever Pierre says, picking horses, and saying stop right there.
There's too many,
and then count the fucking men on the ice. That is Eddie O's. It's his happy place, really, is to count how many men around on the ice to see how many, if there should have been a penalty. That kill was great, and I think that they definitely fed off that kill. Binnington was really good on it. Yeah, I mean, like if you, the Blues had one shot in this game, which was to not have to do anything on special teams either for or against, because their power play sucks balls. Their penalty kill at some point was going to break if the Bruins got three power plays. Statistically, they scored out of one at every fucking three power plays they had. So it is a minor miracle that this game was played as it was with two penalty minutes the entirety of the game. It's sick.
Yeah, I mean, and that really is the reason the Bruins lost, is they couldn't do shit at 5-on-5 this entire series. And that's especially true of the Patrice Bergeron line, which was terrible.
Now, he said after the game that he finally admitted he was injured.
Yeah, no shit,
very,
he's injured.
Very, very big of him. Ryan O'Reilly, by the way, said he had a cracked rib in the Dallas series, and he hurt it more in the San Jose series. And once again, I marvel at how the fuck these people do this shit, where they've got cracked ribs and broken wrists and all kinds of shit, and they're doing it. But that line, man, it's not only that they were outplayed, and I'm sure the injuries have something to do with it, but who the fuck knew that the key to the series would be the Oscar Sundquist line, which is, I mean, played extraordinarily well against both that line and Krejci's line.
Yeah, and got a combined, I think, four penalty minutes on suspendable hits. So
right, yeah, suspendable hits. Right, yeah. I mean, yeah
that's good skill to have.
Yeah,
for sure. Total.
Yeah, I thought the reason they lost last night. Did you notice David Pastrnak at all in that game? Like, he didn't do a thing.
I noticed him whiffing epically in the Ovi spot on the power play at one point. That's the last.
And
the only time I think I noticed
also
him was
blew
that
the back check on the Shen goal. So.
Yeah,
can't say he wasn't there, but
yeah, that's right.
Yikes!
I was surprised that Cassidy didn't try to do more of the kind of chess match thing and moving Pastrnak around a little bit more to the Krejci line like he's done in the past. He needed to kind of, I think, split those guys up more than he did. But it's not as if he was outcoached. I thought Cassidy did a pretty good job during the series. Outside of being unable to pronounce Grizzlick, where it's constantly Grizzlich for some reason.
That is, and so that's like a real Boston thing, because for a very long time it was Milan Lucic, or you would hear Lucic sometimes. Like they just couldn't, you can't get it right. So that's a Boston thing.
Understandable. But I thought that he did pretty well for himself. But I thought that Berube did even better, man. What a fucking coaching job, man. Yep. Like, it's been a constant sort of definition of the Blues that whenever they fuck up, they're able to recover from that fuck up pretty quickly. And look no further than trying to slot rookie Robert Thomas into game six of a series in which he's not 100% and hoping that you can recapture the magic of the maroon Bozak Thomas line from earlier in the playoffs. Oops, that didn't work. He was atrocious. Fuck it. Sammy Blais, get back to your position.
And Sammy Blais had the one play in the game that he needed to make where he made the hit that basically set up the O'Reilly goal, because the Bruins had possession. He fucking buried whoever the puck carrier was in the corner. They turned the puck over, went back to the blue line, shot, redirection, goal. Like,
yeah,
completely against the run of play.
Yeah, and just understanding that, like, what the game was going to end up being, which was going to be a fucking slobber knocker, and knowing that, you know, Robert Thomas wasn't prepared for that, knowing that Robert Pertuzzo was probably not the best option for that, and putting in Joel Edmondson, who was a fucking atrocious earlier in the series, and then knowing that he did the same thing he did in the Dallas series. He played Edmondson, he was kind of shitty, sat him for a couple games, came back, was fine. And last night he was a vital part of that penalty kill early in the first period. So fucking Craig Berube, man, interim coach of the year.
I gotta tell you guys, if he keeps this up, I think he's getting the job. Yeah. He's got a real shot.
Which, by the way, not this has nothing to do with the cup final, but like, what happened to it's Dallas Eakins' job in Anaheim?
Yeah, you guys, I asked you about that like 3 weeks ago, and you were like, no, it's just the AHL thing. And like, is it possible Bob Murray just forgot?
Yeah.
Now, we've all been there.
We've all had that thing on our to-do list that we check off accidentally, and then it's like months later, we're like, oh no.
He's like, oh, wait, coach? Oh, I thought this said couch. Oh, I got the couch reupholstered. I was assuming it was Aiken just by virtue of the timing of things. But the thing I had heard from multiple people throughout the whole process was that Bob Murray didn't want to be the coach. And I heard it again. I heard it again yesterday from somebody where I was asking around saying, like, what do you think of this situation? Or like, well, he's not going to be the coach. He doesn't want to be the coach. Like, that's kind of fucking weird. So who's that cat, the NCAA cat that's
Scott
for the
Sandlin
job? So people think that he might have the inside track for that gig right now.
But he just signed an extension like this week with Minnesota Duluth.
Yeah, but that's like college money, man. The Duckies can come over there and be like, I'll give you some Getzlaff jerseys and let him have his contract.
I mean, Sandlin's won two national titles in a row. It's college money, but he's like making like probably if I had to guess, like $800,000 in rural Minnesota money.
That's like a week of the Corey Perry buyout. That's not a big deal to the Ducks. So the thing about it for me is that like I still come back to the fact that Ducks roster is a veteran roster, and I'm not sure if the NCAA coach is the right fit for, like, you know, trying to still win with your guts laughs of the world.
I think he's
the best option of the ones they're talking about. Like Lane Lambert, I mean, to me, as an assistant, much like Paul Fenton probably should have still have been as a GM, and and Rick Bonus, whatever, right? As far as his ability there, so who's to say? But the one thing I know is that if you're a Ducks fan, whoever the coach is going to be, man, get in line now for tickets.
Oof,
because
yikes.
if they're sold out, what are you going to do?
Very bad.
What are you going to do if it's sold out? I'm going to tell you exactly what you're going to do. You're going to get your ass on SeatGeek. SeatGeek is a proud sponsor of Puck Soup, and by the way, with millions of tickets for live events from sports to live music to comedy and more, SeatGeek has the tickets that you're looking for all in one place. It even rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10 and displays them on an interactive seat map with giant green dots that tell you what are the good deals and red dots that say that things are overpriced. Green means go, red means stop. These are universal colors. That way, you can stop searching for the perfect seat and just start enjoying it. And every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop on SeatGeek with confidence. No wonder SeatGeek has over 50,000 five-star reviews. I've got the SeatGeek app on my phone. Now that this infernal, endless season is finally over, I will put it to good use to relax. Maybe go see a concert. Maybe go see a baseball game. Have a hot dog, as our good friend Mike Mitchell says on Doughboys, Ryan Lambert.
That's right.
Go get a hot dog at the Giants game when either the Mets or the Cubbies come to town so me and Ruby can go. That's what I'll be using SeatGeek for. And here's the deal. SeatGeek will give you $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you got to do is use our promo code. Guess what it is? It's SOUP, S-O-U-P. Download the SeatGeek app today. Enter the promo code SOUP. That's S-O-U-P. That spells SOUP for 10 buckaroos off your first SeatGeek purchase. That's promo code SOUP for $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, they've got tickets, and you now have a promo code to get them. So we haven't talked about the Conn Smythe yet, as Ryan O'Reilly is the big winner. I did see, of course, before Game 7 was played, some very heavy lobbying from one voter in particular, Pierre LeBrun, The Athletic, in which he made the case for Tuukka Rask to win it, win or lose. Do you think it's the fact that O'Reilly scored a goal early in the game and the voters said, all right, the Blues have this in hand, he's got a goal, we can say he's got this thing, that usurped the Tuukka wins at all costs candidacy?
I think it was the 4-on-20, Greg. I think I didn't think any of the goals were Rask's fault, really, and I don't think that should have been enough to paper over an entire playoff of being like a 935 goalie or whatever he ended up being. But also, like, I totally get why it was Ryan O'Reilly. Like you said, if he hadn't scored in that game, I think Rask still wins. But yeah, once he scored and, like, you know, the goals continued to pile up, I was like, yeah, it's going to O'Reilly. There's no doubt in my mind. So
yeah, I'm not a huge fan of losing team winning the Conn Smythe, just because that's typically not how it goes. You could certainly make a case that it should happen more often, but it doesn't. I thought he was going to win because there was no clear pick on St. Louis, and I figured they were going to split all the Blues votes, and Rask was going to win it on the strength of being second or third on a bunch of ballots. That might have happened if it wasn't for, O'Reilly scoring early. If it looked like it was going to be the winning goal in a game seven, I think that gave everybody the green light to make O'Reilly the Blues choice. And once that was the case, then somebody, because to me, you should win based on how it's typically been done. You should win if you're on the losing team, if you are the guy who dragged that team. Mm-hmm. to where they got. Yeah. If you're the JSG Air story, and whereas Tuukka Rask was very, very, very good, but it's not like the Bruins are one goaltender and a bunch of scrubs. So I was happy with how it worked out. I thought they got that call right.
They got it as like, if you were gonna pick somebody from the Blues, the only person it could be was Ryan O'Reilly. And you know, I guess the argument is that it was, what, less than two rounds ago, everybody was like, he's going to be, like, hurt or something. And it turned out he was, apparently. But, like, mm-hmm. he was really bad against Dallas. But at the same time, like, I think I wrote it at the time, but he should be in the top three for the like, regular season MVP as well.
For the heart.
Yeah, he was unbelievable this year. So, like,
He was top three on my ballot,
enough. Like, if he's going to get the Conn Smythe out of it, like, I can't be too mad about it, because it's like, you know what? Like, he was so good in the regular season, and the fact that he had, like, a bad round and a half a round and a half ago, basically, you know, I can't be too mad about it. And he was awesome in the final. So
he disappeared for a little bit in the San Jose series too, but I mean, it might have been like just doing that sort of Jonathan Toews exception of this defensive assignment saps his offense for a little bit. He was the most logical choice, I think. Binnington, It's hard to give the guy the con when he gets pulled in the finals game.
And he had like eight games of below 900 save percentage in the playoffs. Like,
yeah,
he wasn't good for a big chunk of the playoffs. So,
but there's something to be said for his case though. Like the wins after losses.
And if you want to make up, like, you know, on days when it was raining, and
it's not a made up stat. He's fucking 8-2. I mean, there's something to be said for that. Okay, but that's not an argument against Jordan Binnington, though.
Yeah, well, except that he was worse at the thing everybody said he was amazing at than the guy who didn't win the Conn Smythe. Like,
well, he also walked into Winnipeg and won three games. He also walked into Boston and won three games. I mean, something to be said for this kid.
Yeah, and how he played. Right. He was awesome. He was unbelievable. The guy got pulled.
I literally cannot believe that you were still going to be anti-Jordan Binnington after what the fuck you just saw last night.
You called him Chris Osgood like a week ago.
Yeah, Chris Osgood's a money goalie, man. He has a Hall of Fame case based on how good he is in the playoffs. Chris Osgood, if there was a Detroit fan banner, I would be proud to have Chris Osgood wave that banner. He's vital to the success of the Red Wings in their history.
Yeah, Colton Parayko and Alex Pietrangelo were on the ice for 51 minutes last night.
You know what? It sounds like we've got a real, you know, it turns out Marty Brodeur never left the Blues with the arguments you're making about the defenseman making the goalie, apparently.
Didn't you say it was a 95 defenseman or a Devils team? Is that something,
Martin Brodeur was the backbone of that team, sir. And also Scott Niedermeyer and Scott Stevens.
Yeah, it fucking helps.
I think you could make a case for Bennington, but I think that ultimately O'Reilly was the best case. I'm happy that – I mean, you want to talk about recency bias. Pietrangelo was the recency bias. Like, he really had an amazing final, outstanding final.
I thought he kind of struggled early on, honestly, in the final.
I thought overall in the final he played his best hockey, but I think overall in the playoffs, Parayko was the better defenseman.
Oh my God,
although
yeah.
I did, without question. So O'Reilly was a solid choice, but I mean, Sean, it sounds like you might be a little more on the fence on whether so you're saying, since it wasn't a situation where Tuukka dragged a mediocre team kicking and screaming to the final, it's probably not a Conn Smythe year for him.
Right.
It's got to be more of a mediocre team.
And I'm just, again, this is if I was starting a hockey league from scratch and I was going to have a Conn Smythe, I wouldn't have a problem saying it should just go to the best player in the playoffs, even if they lose, even if they don't make the final. If somebody just kills it for three rounds, you want to put Logan Couture on a ballot or something like that?
Yeah, you're talking.
But that's not the way it's historically been. Historically, it's been an award for someone from the winning team unless there is extraordinary circumstances on the losing team, and I don't think this year rose to that. And the thing that I was hoping was not going to happen was that I like I said, I thought Tuukka Rask was going to win, not because he was the best choice, but because he was the second or third choice on a bunch of people who couldn't decide between Ryan O'Reilly and Jordan Binnington and Colton Parayko and Jaden Schwartz and all of those guys would split the Blues vote. And it luckily Ryan O'Reilly came along and solved that problem. And I'm sure fans in Buffalo are just thrilled to see a guy.
Yeah, right.
Who didn't, you know, he didn't quit on that team, but who basically like lost his smile and had to go
right.
away
that
and
team, that,
live in a nice farm
yeah, that
somewhere.
That team made him quit.
And
that team almost made him quit hockey. I mean, that's like yeah. it was the opposite. It was
probably not what you want when you're the Sabres, is to have like one of your star players be like, this place is killing my soul. I need to leave and immediately win the Stanley Cup. And the Conn
Smythe. And be the best player and again have a borderline MVP season.
Yeah.
I'm
sure Jack Eichel's sitting there like, yeah, great, 8 years. Good call.
Yeah, it's but,
great.
But Tage Thompson's gonna have a real big season next year, so
that's,
you know.
That's just it. Like every time Doug Armstrong got asked about that on the ice last night again about the O'Reilly trade, and every time he does it, he has to go back to look, I mean, listen, the Sabres got some quality players. We didn't want to give up a Tage Thompson. We didn't want – and I'm just wondering, at some point, will he start laughing? Like, will he start cackling at some point during one of these soliloquies?
He was winking a lot when he said that.
Yeah. Fucking Ryan O'Reilly. Could have been a Hart and Conn Smythe winner potentially this year. Insane. Absolutely insane. A good choice for the Conn, I think, at the end of the day. Yep. The Conn Smythe was handed out post-game. Bettman comes out, ladies and gentlemen, and gets booed, as is everybody's wont. Sean, where are you on Bettman getting booed? You seem like someone who might be over that.
I this is like a big thing for me, because I've written a bunch about the Gary Bettman awkward handoffs, and every year people ask me to rate them and continue on that. And this year's was fine. Like
it's unfortunately fine.
it was fine. Like there's a couple things you look for. First of all, let's just say the booing was very mild. And I understand that it's not a close game. Most of the
shit, dude.
Yeah. Like, half the building had left. So
they're at a pub.
I do get that. But can we just point out that if that's what it had sounded like in Vegas last year, everybody would be talking about how Vegas fans weren't real fans yet because they didn't boo Gary Bettman loud enough. So it was right, very mild right. booing. The photo went on a little too long. The Gary Bettman hand, the crazy finger pointing thing that like has a mind of its own that he can't control, was doing its usual crazy thing. But it was relatively smooth. I didn't love the fireworks. I don't know why we borrowed Bill Goldberg's entrance pyro.
Yeah.
For that moment.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Other than that, it was like it was
also,
fine. It wasn't. You
am
know.
I am I wrong?
What's that?
Am I wrong that that podium was new too? Like the podium that said the Stanley Cup or whatever the fuck it said last night?
Yeah, I don't remember.
I think that was also new. So you got fireworks and the fire. Honestly, like I was looking at the front page of NHL.com and the photo is kind of cool. Like it's all the sparks in the background and Pietrangelo lifting the, Pietrangelo lifting the cup. And it says Stanley, the podium says Stanley Cup champions. It kind of looks like a garbage can a little bit, which is unfortunate, but I don't know. Like, aesthetically, it seems like you don't need it because of that moment is so beautiful in and of itself that you don't need sparklers in the background.
That's the thing. Like that. That's like especially if you're a Blues fan, you've been waiting 52 years. Like you want to see your guy take the cup, right? Like that's it. That's the moment where he's going to take the cup. You don't need the fireworks going off in the background. So. I don't know about that, but you know, guys. Speaking of great takes that produce fireworks.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
that was. I gotta give it to you. That
we're,
was.
We're gonna need B- to. We're gonna need to. Plus. We're gonna. We're I'll gonna need it. To forge another Conn Smythe trophy and give it to yeah, Sean.
It is. It is. It is way too early for me to do any better than that. So, The Athletic is a direct consumer subscription service. Serving sports fans in North America. The model is simple. There are no ads, no pop-ups, no autoplay videos, and Gary Bettman does not make you pose for photographs for an uncomfortably long amount of time. For a photograph that we never see. Those photos have... All right, I've done that one already. Instead, readers subscribe for authentic, in-depth coverage written and now spoken by journalists who know the league inside and out. You get all of the league-wide news from NHL experts like Pierre LeBrun, Katie Strang, and others... as well as local coverage for every team in the league. So what you need to do is go to theathletic.com/soup for a 40% off discount to The Athletic. That is theathletic.com/SOUP, all lowercase, for 40% off. That ends up being about $2.99 a month for more than 1,000 stories published each week, as well as audio content. So subscribe right now using promo code SOUP, download The Athletic app from the App Store, and come experience The Athletic stories told in a whole new way. There's your ad.
There it is. It was beautifully done, beautifully rendered. Let's talk a bit about what happens now with the Boston Bruins besides copious amounts of Visine to treat those teary eyes like Brad Marchand had after losing the cup.
You hate to see it. You really do.
You hate to see it, and you hate to meme it as it will be in perpetuity now. What do you think about where the Bruins are and where they might be headed?
It's tough, man. You know, I don't want to say like this was their last chance at it because I really don't think it was. But, you know, this team kind of had everything come together for them a little bit in the playoffs. And
boy, did they.
And, you know, they have enough talent, like, and including young talent to you know, stay competitive. But. You can't count on Tampa shitting the bed again. You can't count on beating the Leafs at next year. You can't. Right. Okay. Sure.
It might be
like death and taxes, sir. Yeah.
You know, there's just like the amount of the Florida's likely to get much better this summer. Let's not forget that. And yeah, I don't know, man. I this was their chance. And they didn't come through, and that's how it goes sometimes. But at the same time, you gotta say maybe this was it, and they just shit their pants at home in Game 7. Brutal.
They shit their pants, but I was thinking about that last night. It's. I know that there's some fucking townie in the upper deck going, "Hey, Rob, they need to try harder." The Blues played a really fucking good game in Game 7. I can't fault the Bruins for losing that game. I think you know the better 5-on-5 team won last night.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But also, like, maybe try getting to the net to get one of the 58 rebounds Jordan Binnington gave up.
There it is. What about you, Sean? Do you think this is it for the Bruins?
You know, I've got my take on this is really boring. Which is I'm not going to say this is it because I think we've learned over the last few years from teams like the Capitals that declaring windows have been closed is...
Well, even this Bruins team, right?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
2 years ago, they thought they were going to be bad. Mm-hmm. When they brought Cassidy aboard, like, they weren't expecting them to be any good. And they're still a good team. Like, the roster's still solid, but...
And the roster's solid. There's no big free agency. Does, you know, there's no, the cap is tight, but there's not like some sort of cap crunch where you're going to be forced to move out big pieces. I mean, the boring take is it sucks. You play the whole year to get game seven at home. You don't come through. You bring the squad back and you take another run at it next year. And yep. You know, you don't, you're going to go into the season as one of the probably six or eight teams that are considered favorites. And that's probably the best you can ask for. And you take another swing. You hope you don't get run over by fatigue next year, which sometimes happens to teams that go real deep. But sometimes doesn't. They've got as good a shot as anybody, and you got at least one more swing of the axe, so to speak, and see where that leads you.
I think they could win the East next year. They have to do one thing, a couple things. They have to buy out Backus, obviously, or find someone that'll take him. But I don't know who would, unless they need the cap money. And I think that is tied to them needing to address that second line winger conundrum that's been vexing them forever, where I thought the answer would be Charlie Coyle, but it turns out that they want him to be a center instead. So they need to go out and figure out a second line wing, get themselves a dominant guy, and go from there. But other than that, I mean, the D is good. I also think it's going to be really interesting to see what they do with Krug. I can't imagine a scenario where you go 33% of the power play for the entirety of the playoffs and then trade your quarterback and hand the keys to, like, Matt Grizzlick. But the financial realities of Torrey Krug are that he's making 5.25. He's a free agent in summer 2020. And how much are they really going to give this Smurf? Like, are they going to keep him? Are they going to trade him?
I think you got to keep him. The thing you're saying about, like, well, they got to give him a shitload more money in summer 2020. You know who's 58 years old and makes a pretty good amount of money and probably doesn't have too much tread left on the tire is another defenseman on the Boston Bruins.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah. This is true. I agree. But he's only making $2 million against the cap next year as Chara.
Is that because isn't there like bonuses and stuff like that that are very easy to reach? I'm pretty sure. That's the case.
I'm sure that's probably the case. But the point is that the Bruins, this would not be the first time that a defenseman has priced himself out of the Bruins payroll, if in fact that ends up being the case with Krug. And you know, power play quarterback being arguably, outside of goaltender, the most, you know, well, I don't know, maybe it is the most valuable commodity. Probably great 200-foot center is probably the most coveted thing. And then power play quarterback might be the second.
Power play quarterback on power play that succeeds 40% of the time is probably pretty valuable. It's going to depend on whether he has his helmet on during the negotiations. If the helmet comes off, he gains superpowers, and then he'll be unstoppable.
So you think Chara's with bonuses? Chara's contract is 3.75.
Okay. Manageable,
if you get an extra 3.75 to give Torrey Krug, and that makes him a $9 million player. Like, that makes sense to me.
If Kenny Holland came to the Bruins tomorrow and said, "We'll give you the Nuge for Krug," would you do it?
No.
Oh, okay. That's always the place I figured he'd end up if there was a deal. But I'm surprised that you guys just seem a lot more optimistic they're going to commit to this guy long term, which makes me happy because I like him. Oh, and the one contract they do have to give out, and this is actually a pretty significant one, and it's gonna be fascinating to see exactly how it plays out. Charlie McAvoy is a restricted free agent. So do they give him the big Ekblad level deal, or they give him a bridge deal through it, you know, him being shackled as an RFA? Be interested to see how that thing plays out.
Yeah, Brandon Carlo is also an RFA.
Yeah, easy.
So they have to sign. They have to spend a good chunk of money on the blue line this summer for sure.
Yeah.
What do they have for space?
All right, there you go.
Well, they have $40 million to spend. I think they'll be okay.
and obviously the Blues repeat, right? I mean, they're on track to be a defending Cup champion next year. Everything will fall in place again, right?
They got to be last place on January 1st. So that's what you spend the first half of the season working towards. And then you flip the switch and it's a dynasty.
Well, so here's the thing, right? Like, to the point about Osgood is, you know, they don't need Jordan Binnington to be a 940 goalie if they're just good all year. If he's league average, they're great again. And, I, you know, he since the start of March, he's been a roughly league average goalie, and that's all they've needed him to be. And so, yeah, like I can totally see them being a dominant team in the West
and,
again. This
and by year. The way, guys, it just speaking of guys who need new contracts, like Jordan Binnington, I believe, needs a new deal, and
he does.
That's going to get interesting because
he's an RFA, but I think he's arbitration eligible, which is even more interesting. Like, yeah. What's the comp for that? Fucking Cam Ward.
Yeah,
like it's crazy. I was being flippant, but the core of that team is very good. And they have a bunch of younger players too that are filling out that lineup that they've been waiting on. I mean, you know, a kid like Thomas is only going to get better, and so on and so forth. So it's good to be the Blues right now. I think overall, if you're thinking about contenders in the West, and to answer your question, the answer is if you fire Berube in January, you have to then hire a Flyers retread, so Dave Haxtell, come on down. There it is, baby. All right. The Stanley Cup Final. Let's go. Stanley Cup Final letter grade, Stanley Cup Playoffs letter grade. What say you?
Oh, boy.
Go ahead, Sean.
The final, I would say, I mean, the final will be remembered as a very good final because it went seven. I don't think, I mean, in terms of classics, I wouldn't put it up there with some of the other ones. Game seven wasn't great. Game six wasn't great. There was the other blowout. There was the officiating controversy. We got one overtime. I would say it's a B+, the final and the playoffs itself. I mean, it kind of depends. If you're saying like in terms of being interesting, that it was, this was a fantastic playoffs, but they were interesting for the wrong reason a lot of the time. So, we did the whole debate over whether all the chaos in the first round was good or bad, but most people seemed to like it. And even if you didn't like it, the rest of the next three rounds kind of settled down in that regard. So it didn't feel like it was complete randomness the whole playoffs. I thought the playoffs were pretty good. I mean, the officiating controversies were obviously a big part of what we're going to remember. I think overall, I was certainly never bored. Let's put it that way. So I don't know what grade that translates to, but I thought it was a pretty fun couple of months.
And here I am assuming that your grading system is the same as here it is in the States. I don't know. You probably use like numbers or some shit instead of A's and
yeah,
B's.
Yeah, it's five or whatever. I don't know what goes on up there.
I would give the final a B. It's funny you bring up the Vancouver series before, Sean, because the more I think about it, this is sort of the if you take an R-rated movie and put it on regular TV, that's kind of what this series is. Yep. It's that version of the Vancouver series. Like, yeah. No crazy controversies. No Nathan Horton hit. No, Sedin getting punched in the face 75 times. No shit talking between the two goalies. But kind of the bones of the series are the same, where the hockey really wasn't that good, but it was never boring. I'd give it a B overall. Maybe inch it up to a B+ for there having been a game seven. But you're right. There was way too many games that were so not competitive that.
Yeah.
How many lead changes did we actually have in the series?
Probably not many. Not many. Yeah.
So that's, I'd have to give it a B overall for the playoffs. I'd say A-. Only because of the incredible unpredictable nature of it, and as much as the officiating controversies made us all go mental on this podcast, having to talk about them every episode, they did make for good copy and good fun. And really, like any playoff that involves a sweep of the one of the greatest regular season teams of all time in the first round by the fucking Blue Jackets, no less, and games six and seven of the Sharks Vegas series, got to at least rank an A- in my book. That's some shit that you can't. You get one of those moments in a playoff, and you're happy.
And
you had
and
a couple
also
of them like that.
Three game seven overtimes, which was that's like a decade's worth.
Oh.
So.
And great stories too. I mean, God, like the double overtime game in game seven between Dallas and St. Louis, fucking Pat Maroon wins it. Dude goes home to be with his kid, scores a game winning goal for his hometown team and all that shit. Like there was a ton of that stuff going on here. That's a solid A- for me, these playoffs. Maybe it becomes an A if there was a little bit more violence, but that's just my own predilection.
Yeah, I would have said an A for the playoffs. I had a lot of fun. Like, I think these are the most fun playoffs I remember, like, front to back in quite a long time. So, for everything you guys said, like, I think that's an A for me.
Dog.
Sure. but I kind of thought the finals were a bit more of a dud than you guys. Just like you guys said, like, a lot of the games weren't competitive. It was just one team being like, no, we're just going to crush the other guys. And then, you know, they traded those back and forth for a little while. And you know, I thought game five was probably the only, like, actually fun, good game. Like, actually good game in the whole series, so...
Right, and that's the game everyone talks about, the trip. That's, like, going to be the moment everyone remembers.
And so, like, even that's marred by controversy. Like, I think I'd give it a C, where it was just, like... I mean, it certainly could have been worse, but, like, there was just nothing in, like, the actual entertainment of the quality of hockey that I was, like... you know, this is the aesthetic I'm looking for in my sport in 2019.
A C plus if it was in the Tokyo Dome. Couple more topics to cover here. I do want to touch on the two incredible controversies that touched both of our nations this week in sports. The alleged cheering of an injury in Toronto when Kevin Durant went down in game five for the Golden State Warriors, and the over-exuberance of the U.S. women's national team in celebrating roughly 75 goals against Thailand. And the classic word in both cases used, of course, was
class. Yep, absolutely.
Where is the class?
Stay classy.
Sean, as the resident Canadian, what were your thoughts on the Durant situation?
See, here's what I had to keep my mouth shut on this one, because I know, as the, I am, even though I haven't lived in Toronto in 20 years, I'm viewed as a Toronto guy. David Staples says I'm a Toronto writer. So I just stayed out of this one, but I just want to say I wrote about this topic 10 years ago, when, if you guys remember, in the Wings Penguins series, you had a kind of similar situation where Sidney Crosby was banged up and he came back and then he got hit and he left and he like went down the tunnel, and Red Wings fans cheered and everybody freaked out and told them to be classy and all of this stuff. And I wrote at the time, I had no problem with fans being happy about minor or run-of-the-mill sports injuries to their opponents. I think it's ridiculous that we have to pretend that these games are really important and we really care and we're really emotionally invested, but when something happens that makes your team more likely to win, if it involves an injury, you're supposed to bow your head and get very, very solemn and say that none of this matters. I think if it's a serious injury, different deal. Clearly, if it's a season-ending injury or something that's going to affect somebody's quality of life, then yes, of course, that's bigger than sports, and you shut up. But I think that with the Kevin Durant situation, what happened is, I mean, first of all, I've heard people say, well, you know, as soon as he goes down, they start cheering. Yeah, the game's still going on at that point. Like, the Raptors are going down the other way to score. So, yes, the crowd's going to be cheering. When everybody looks back and sees him sitting on the court, at first, nobody knows that this is a serious injury, okay? Like, this is a guy who had missed a few weeks with a strained calf, which is a serious injury for a basketball player, but that's a sports injury. That stuff happens, okay? That's nobody's shedding any tears over a strained calf. When you see him just sitting on the court, he's not writhing in pain, he's not pounding on the floor, he's not holding his leg up and his foot's pointing in the wrong direction. He's just holding his leg. Everybody goes, oh, the calf's flared up again. He's going to have to come out of the game. Maybe he's not going to come back in the game. Maybe he's out of the series. All of that stuff makes your team more likely to win. I've got no problem with anyone being happy that an opponent suffers what looks like an unpleasant but pretty run-of-the-mill injury. Now, as soon as people realize it's something more serious than that, which once the trainer gets out and you can see him talk to some of the other players, and the Achilles is that's one of those injuries where, as it's been explained to me, you know as soon as it happens exactly what has happened. At that point, everybody shuts up. Everybody starts cheering him. They chant his name as he goes down the tunnel, which I've never heard before. And they're currently raising money for his charity. They're up to like $20,000. So if through all of that, we're still going to play the you're not classy card, then I think at this point I kind of want off the classy bus, because this is all getting kind of ridiculous. So that's my defense of Toronto fans that I couldn't do earlier in the week because I would just get called a homer. But it's completely consistent with what I've been saying for the last decade on this stuff that didn't involve Toronto fans in any way.
Finally, someone in the Canadian media comes to the defense of the Toronto fans, only yes. Two of whom actually clapped. And they actually formed a one of those fire chains in the old days where they would hand each other water buckets, but that was to carry him to a hospital.
Yes. And it still would not have been enough.
Free health care, by the way. I don't know. And there was no school shootings. And yep, yeah, we get it. No, like, Canadian fans are the very best in the world, and actually they would never do anything bad.
No, they're not. They're exactly the same as fans everywhere else. And that's why, like, fans in – anytime this happens anywhere, and fans in other fan bases try to score points, like, oh, yeah, well, you know, you would do the exact same thing. And it's completely this you know, this rush to – as soon as it happened, you knew. You were like, oh, here we go. We're going to listen to 2 days of classy takes and – delivered.
Like,
we got him.
To your point about, like, they didn't know right away that it was like a serious injury.
Yeah.
I was watching that game, that was right away. It was like, oh, he's
so
fucked.
When you saw him, when the camera cuts back and he's sitting on the court, just holding his leg, You said this is an Achilles, not his calf strain.
His calf strain, like, I thought, like, you know, that was maybe his calf basically turning into hamburger meat in his leg. Like, I instantly was like, well, oh, he's fucked. And you know, the thing about, like, because what they had always said was, like, if he re-injures it, like, it's a really long recovery or something like that. And now it's looking like, yeah, he's going to be out to like December next year.
Because he tore his Achilles. Yeah, I mean, that's going
to
be
the other thing you have to understand is that, like, if you are a basketball player and you have a calf injury, it makes you much more susceptible to an Achilles injury. That then is insane.
I'm
glad you knew that and factored it into your reaction in the moment. But you should maybe you should give the Warriors a call, because they apparently didn't know that.
Yeah,
the
Warriors had no idea that. Yeah, okay. Like, because wasn't it yesterday? Fucking Steve Kerr was like, "Would we put him in again?" Yeah, we would. And it's like,
right. Yeah.
Ooh, boy, nuts. I don't know, dude. Like that
I kind of fall
on that Jalen Rose shit, man, where it's like...
If everybody hadn't already fired up the very well-worn let's blame the fans outrage machine, there should be a lot more outrage pointed at the Warriors story should be.
I think you can talk about both at once, but, like, Charles Barkley was on the intermission show last night and was like, you know, what do you think about that whole thing? And he's like, he shouldn't have been playing. Like, right. and that I started to say it, like, that was the Jalen Rose thing. I don't remember if it was on like First Take or what it was, but he was like, he used a quote that he attributed to somebody else, and he was like, they'll bring flowers to your funeral, but not soup when you're sick. And it's like, yeah, man.
Wow.
That's really what it's all about. Like, they, they were like, well, you know what? We know that we're putting Kevin Durant at risk, but, like, we got to at least win one game to make this a respectable final, or we're going to feel shitty about ourselves. So, and he's probably not going to be on our team next year anyway. So fuck it. And, like, that
shit
sucks.
Get it right, by the way. It's NBC hockey analyst Charles Barkley.
Man, can we get him to replace Keith Jones? God damn, he was actually good. They asked him,
All right,
Now freeze it. Freeze it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six players on the ice right there. You can't be scoring a goal that way.
Yeah, the problem is he's not going to know who Rob Thomas play for.
Junior.
But
Duncan Eddie.
They said, like, who's the Kawhi of the NBA or of the NHL? And he said Sidney Crosby. And it's like, fuck, man, that's exactly right. Like, that's
– there you go.
Yeah.
I fall on Sean's side. I think that the Neanderthalic response of fans to something that benefits their team is a natural response. I am a huge fan of the very Canadian overcorrection for one's behavior, where they're actually fucking raising money to, like, help out the guy's charity because they feel so sorry about having cheered his injury. But that said, Like Ryan was hinting at, the thing that drove me fucking mental was the protectionism of Canadian fans, the that's not us bullshit from every goddamn fucking writer in Canada outside of Sean.
Hold on. Which ones? Because Bruce Arthur ripped on the Toronto fans who cheered. He defended the ones who didn't.
There was the basketball writer for The Athletic literally did a 5-point fucking presentation on Twitter as to why what happened with the fans and don't give him shit for it. And other guy, it was
that
a
video
constant,
of Jurassic Park after where people were like waving as he's being checked out and that kind of thing, like, oof,
yeah,
brutal.
But it was always, and it was the usual, like, oh, it was only a few bad eggs or whatever the fuck, or they were booing something. Who gives a
that was one of Bruce's things, you should be allowed to.
He was like, they were actually cheering for the steal and not okay, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. Like fucking own it. Like, it's fine. It's shitty. Everybody's shitty. It means that you're just as shitty as Philly when you shit on Philly for being shitty.
Yep.
But, like, it just acknowledge that it happened and don't try to, like, fucking Zapruder film this shit where, like, they're trying to say, oh, well, there was the kiss cam on the Jumbotron at the time. I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Well, like,
and I agree with that. Go back and read what I could list the 10 biggest basketball writers and media people in Canada, and I bet you we go back 7 or 8 of them are mostly critical of the fans who cheered. I mean, if one or two guys found their way into your timeline, then we apologize on behalf of the entire Canadian media, but don't paint us all with this.
Half of them were saying the cheering didn't happen, or that the cheering happened.
Everybody was saying it was like, you know, six guys or whatever. It wasn't
the whole arena. It was more than six guys, obviously. It wasn't 20,000 people. That's not what 20,000 people cheering sounds like. And yeah, it is perfectly valid when somebody else says the second he got hurt, they cheered to point out the game was still going on. They were cheering because the Raptors scored a bat. Like, that is if pointing that out is not owning it, I mean, you're allowed to say what you can see with your eyes right in front of you. If you're not, then, I mean, I guess we're really down a weird place with this.
Yeah, I don't know. There was a lot, too much sort
wagon
of like
circling.
Yeah, wagon circling, apologizing for the fans when it was just like like you said from the top, Sean, like the perfect Neanderthalic response to something that benefits your team. It's everyone's gonna fucking do it, and it's fine. It's sports.
By the way, can we also talk about the Toronto Sun being like, wouldn't it be better if the Raptors had Canadian guy on there? And then it's like, yeah, you guys know who the fucking Chris Boucher is? He was on the Warriors last year. Like,
to steal a bit from the press box in the Ringer, the overworked Twitter joke of the week by far was how many people responded to that headline by saying, you know what, the Raptors need more dinosaurs on their team. Mm-hmm. Just a great fucking line.
And to put that in context, just for people who might not understand, the Toronto Sun sucks. There you go. That's it.
It's the Canadian newspaper equivalent of Fox News, pretty much. Like, it's bad.
Yeah, it'd be like if somebody tried to put Fox News into the New York Post and then was like, whoa, this is way too complicated and intelligent. Let's dumb it down.
Right.
That would be it.
As far as the women's national team, I've already planted my flag here, too. I don't give a shit, man. The thing that bothers me is the people who went to the but what about the kids argument. Yeah, what about the young soccer player, let's say like my 9-year-old daughter who's watching the World Cup and seeing these women, these incredible women, these women who put their careers on the line to get as much money as the men make, celebrating and having fun and doing all kinds of cool shit. Like, yeah, that would really fucking repel her from wanting to be an athlete, to see, you know, fucking athletes celebrating their accomplishments in the goddamn World Cup.
Yeah, like a lot of it was like that I saw from, again, Canadians. What was
do you guys need to follow different Canadians? Because I don't know where this we have more than three Twitter accounts. You probably
so don't follow Haley Wickenheiser.
Yeah, I was gonna say, dude,
30 million of us. I know. I apologize that every time this stuff happens, you see three tweets from various Canadians, and that's the entire country. But
so,
like, Haley Wickenheiser, the thing is, nobody's upset about how many goals they scored. Like, I haven't seen
so that's
one
what I was
take
gonna
about
say,
that.
Though. That's what I was going to say, though. It's like, well, you're only talking about they ran up the score, and we're talking about the celebration. And it's right. Like, you know what, dude? Like, if you score fucking 13 goals, like, if you're Haley Wickenheiser, because I'm sure that Canadian team beat, like, the Latvian women's team 115 sure. to -5 one time.
Yeah.
And, like, at some point, yeah, maybe you do, like, because it really, for coming from the hockey point of view of it, it really read a lot like "please like my sport" shit to me, where it's like, I, you know, I personally scored 58 goals against the Russian team when the Russian team was like three women named Ludmilla and that's it, right? And and I, you know, I actually just put my head down and skated back to the bench and cried because of how bad I felt that we scored all those goals. And it's like, okay, like, you're, that's fine, but like, also, you know, like, Christine Sinclair didn't go out and score 58 goals, and if she did, and if she celebrated it, I go, yeah, well, I mean, she scored 58 goals, so that's fine.
Okay, so if Canada went and beat somebody 13-0 and they were doing choreographs sliding along the ice, doing leg lift celebrations, you guys would think that was fine, sure. Sometimes the consensus take is just the right take. Score as many goals as you want, but don't celebrate like when you're running over some nation that doesn't even belong on the field with you. It's not cool. It's not the end of the world. Nobody should care about this 2 days from now. But yeah, but most people were right when they looked at that and went, "That's too much. Settle down. It's not fun. It's just
again like what. But I come back to the storm surge conversation, like. Remember when people were pissed off? Well, okay, like a few people were pissed about the storm surge because they thought it was showing up their opponents. Like, why is a celebration automatically default setting showing up your opponent? Why is it not just celebrating with your teammates?
I think. Like, I don't understand when you're running across the field,
they're not taunting
and, like,
the fucking
doing,
bench.
Like, little, I don't know. At some point,
they're not Lars Eller taunting the fucking Bruins bench, so Brad Marchand has to assault him. They were just celebrating amongst themselves.
Amongst them, well, sliding across the field. Like, I mean, this, like, nobody's saying don't high five or hug or smile or something like that. But, and it's, you know, as far as to go back to Haley Wickenheiser, when this happens, people are always like, well, until you've been in that situation, you don't get to say, well, here's somebody who's been in the situation going, yeah, no, I've been in exactly that situation. And no, I didn't act that way.
I got more than a little problem with her taking a run at the fucking women's national soccer team, who, by the way, like, put their asses on the line to get the thing that Wick says she's been fighting for her entire career. And there's trickled down to the other two hockey teams in North America for what they've done. Holster your fucking gun. Don't take a fucking shot at them.
That's just my take on it. All right. So basketball fans can't be emotional, but soccer players who have been around for doing this their whole lives, I don't know. I wasn't a fan of it.
I think we solved it.
I wouldn't. If I was the 8-year-olds I coached started acting like that when they were up 13-0, I'd probably have to tell them to settle down. But
yeah, but these are professional athletes, so it's
not, yeah. That's the
are.
Thing too.
So,
there,
so
I, everybody
higher
knows
standard,
that your kid's
not, a lower
not supposed
one
to do that.
Than what
no,
you expect
fine.
From
there could,
rambunctious kids.
There could be
you
a
don't want people celebrating. Don't give up 13 fucking goals. I don't know what.
Yeah, Thailand.
Like, look, I don't think Canada is going to be in a position to score as many in group play because they're not in the group with Thailand. Their next game's against New Zealand, and then after that, it's against the Netherlands. And those are not, like, complete afterthought. Like, because what you have to understand is, like, Thailand isn't even the worst team in the Women's World Cup this year. Like, yep. The U.S. and France are just so much better than everybody else they're going to play that, that like, they're going to – 13-0 is going to – is probably going to be the ugliest score of the tournament, but there are going to be other real ugly ones too.
Hey, just remember this game when Thailand wins the next World Cup and they and
right. they're in the
this
last
experience
place
as the reason why that competitive fire was lit. Their numbers spiked locally. Legions of young Thai women come out to play soccer because they're so mad about what happened in this U.S. game. We've what's the line from The Last Jedi? We're the spark that lights the fuse that burns down the First Order or what have you.
Something
that's exactly
like that, yeah.
That's exactly what the women's national team did. All right, one more topic to touch on before we head out. Is there any other hockey things you wanted to talk about? I for one, forgot to mention before how fucking insanely wonderful it was that the St. Louis Post-Dispatch printed the owner of the St. Louis Blues letter in their digital edition congratulating the fans on a Stanley Cup victory that hadn't happened yet on the day of Game 6. That is one of the most titanically wonderful fuck-ups in journalism in recent memory.
Yeah, yeah, pretty bad. You don't want to
that
do
would
that.
Live forever.
But then it didn't matter.
Lost.
So,
yeah, it was awesome. Competition committee met, and we are going to find out a lot more about the stuff when they have the annual meetings in Vegas before the awards to see what might stick here. They've mentioned a few things. We'll start off on the lower end of the thing. Changes in face-off procedures. Was it you, Sean, that said that the competition committee ignores all the big topics, but they never met a face-off procedure.
I wish I loved anything in my life as much as the competition committee loves tweaking face-off procedures.
It's fucking 100%.
Every year, they're just like messing around with like what. but I will say this: there is actually something interesting, or something at least that I found really interesting, buried in this little. Release that doesn't tell us anything about what really that they actually did, and that's the net being knocked off. They have changed the procedure for the net being knocked. Right now, when the net gets knocked off, if the referee feels it's intentional, he can call it a penalty. But otherwise, it's just a standard issue stoppage. And they have changed it so that the referee can still call a penalty, but if he doesn't. If the defensive team knocks the net off, it'll be treated like icing. Basically, they don't get there's a face off, and no option to change, no line change, which drives me crazy because this is exactly what everyone or what many of us want them to do with the puck over glass rule, which is if it's intentional, call it a penalty. Otherwise, treat it like icing. And here you have the net being off is literally the next item in the rule book. It's the same section as the puck going over the glass. It's the next item, and here they are. Like, they're so close to figuring it out. Like, you know when you see someone, you're like, you're just waiting for the light bulb to go off. You're like, they're almost there. They've almost got it. They've almost figured this out on the puck over glass thing, but they missed by, like, one rule and applied it to something else.
There had to be at least 17 puck over glass penalties in that final. It felt like it was rough.
Oh, but you see, Greg, it's so black and white. They call it the same every time after they've met for 15 minutes to talk about where the puck.
And also, as long as it's not overtime of the
as long as it's not game 7 overtime. Which case,
right? Exactly. A couple things that were interesting. The regulation tiebreaker or the regulation tiebreaker thing. Just making the first tiebreaker regulation wins. Round of a fucking applause.
Yep, hell yeah.
Anything that puts more emphasis on the first 60 minutes versus any of the circus shit that comes later.
I don't think this is going to fix any of the problems of players or coaches coaching for overtime and players playing to get to overtime.
But I agree.
There's a part of me that hopes this is a very small first step towards finally just going to a 3-2-1 system. Like, this is the first acknowledgement that regulation should be more important than. So I'm choosing the optimist view, and I'm saying this is the first little baby step towards where they need to get to.
And then the committee recommends changes to the coach's challenge and expanded video review, including as it relates to a referee's ability to review some of his own calls on the ice. So things are real vague. I'm sure details will come out by the time you hear this as far as what that actually means. But the recommendation is to expand review. And whatever they decide, whatever tweaks they want to make, it does come back to something that to me is the most important thing in this debate right now, which is that Gary Bettman is bullish on expanding video review. And he's, you know, even for things like the hand pass situation in the San Jose St. Louis series, you know, Bettman said, you know, what if the hand pass happens a minute and a half before the goal is scored? So they're going to have to kind of figure out a way to appease him and his concerns about what to review and when to review it and how long ago something gets reviewed before they're going to be able to expand replay for some of these things that we've seen in the playoffs, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, it is tough. I wrote a couple more things about that this week. Like, this is people can read my pieces if they want to know like what I would do or what I think the answers are. But I will say, like, these questions are hard, and I'm so tired of people saying that it's easy. Like, just review it, just get it right. There's a lot of things you have to actually figure out when you're going to do this, and I'd love to know if the NHL has figured that out. I wish I did, instead of just reading a paragraph that doesn't actually tell me anything. I don't think that's a great start, the fact that they're already back into typical NHL mode of we're doing something, but we're not going to tell you what it is. But maybe I'll reserve judgment until we get the scoop at some point on what they're actually proposing. I'm not optimistic, given that it's coming from the same group that came up with offside and interference reviews, but maybe they'll surprise us.
Mm, indeed. All right, that's Puck Soup for this week. Congratulations to the St. Louis Blues on their first Stanley Cup in franchise history. By the way, didn't mention this. How fucking cool is it they opened up Busch Stadium for a viewing party in St. Louis?
Yeah, that was sick.
That was sick. Like, that's something I don't think I've seen before. Really awesome. That's fucking cool as shit. And I really enjoyed my time in St. Louis. I know it's a scary place for a lot of people who grew up in Chicago. I know that I used to make fun of their food. I believe I once said that they ate like raccoons in St. Louis. But I had a really good time. I ate some good food. I met some great people. And I couldn't be happier for those people to finally get a taste of this thing. I got a little misty on the ice last night watching little Layla Anderson running over and hugging Colton Parayko and stuff. I think, you know, we all root for the narrative, you know, when you're a writer and the better stories. I think clearly it was more interesting to write about the Blues last night than it were the Bruins. But yeah, good for them. It was a good time. Anyway, I'm Greg Wyshynski of ESPN. You can listen to my other podcast, ESPN on Ice, with Emily Kaplan. We've broken down Game 7 and all that good stuff with Levy and Melrose last night. That should be up at some point. And also, I did some reminiscing with Jimmy Traina on the SI Media podcast, talking about the Puck Daddy days and talking about the NHL media in general. That was fun this week.
Yeah, you can sign up if you want to, and you should want to, because I do a good job. The Puck Soup newsletter, where I talk about hockey and movies and music and TV shows and that kind of thing. Basically trying to distill what I would say on the podcast, but we didn't talk about it on the show too much, into just, you know, a quick, not necessarily that quick, but like a bullet pointsy kind of a column. So yeah, if you remember the Puck Daddy power rankings, it's basically that, but with more pop culture stuff in it.
All right.
Nice. And you can find my stuff at The Athletic, including those pieces I just mentioned about offside review. My 10-point plan on how I would fix this when I am named commissioner. So you can read that so that you won't be surprised when it happens.
Awesome. Check out the mailbag on the Patreon. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And Sean's dying. He just coughed up a lung. I saw it. R.I.P. Sean. And
I'm all right.
We'll talk to you next week. Bye.
See
you.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to what if you commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, eats and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Puck Soup.